Well, on Sunday evenings, we've been looking at Revelation chapter 16, and we've been thinking about the wrath to come. Now, if you remember, Revelation is a picture book. That's the level at which it works. It's a series of overlapping pictures. They're very vivid, but they're pictures from before time to the endless ages to come. And so when we come to chapter 16, we find seven scenes. It's a picture with seven scenes, seven last plagues, seven bowls of the wrath of God. Seven pictures of the totality of God's destruction coming upon this world. It's the final climactic drama. Now, so far we've looked at the first six plagues. There's no timeline. They don't follow one after the other. This is not about times and seasons. This is prophetic, apocalyptic language. Very vivid. And it's simply speaking about the totality, about the full weight, the full measure of God's wrath to come. So we looked at plague number one, where we discover that rebellious humanity is dehumanized. All that makes us truly human, all that bears the image of God, love, beauty, peace, joy, order, reason, those things are stripped away. Plague two, God sucks the life out of his creation, leaving death and the curse to run their course. Plague three, rivers of blood as God goes to war and avenges his people. Plagues four and five, we have the scorching sun and the agonizing darkness. Five visions of hell. And then plague number six, Armageddon. It's the last battle where humankind is united as never before in one great global conspiracy. Satan, he unites the nations in, if you like, one sort of pan-human alliance against the Lord, against his people, for the final assault on the church, and it'll be a day of universal worldwide persecution. The Church of Jesus Christ under assault as never before. And if you remember, when all seems lost, it's then the gates of heaven are thrown open, and out rides the Lord Jesus Christ at the head of his glorious armies. And he's coming to rescue his bride. And as the last enemy falls, so he gathers her up, just as he said he would, and the two lovers return to heaven, united forever. But do you see, plague number six, the United Nations, the nations united against God, well, Christ will destroy them in a decisive battle, Armageddon, at his coming. And the triumph of man will actually end, will actually become the day of the Lord and the destruction of the wicked. Which therefore leaves us with plague number seven. And if seven in the book of Revelation is the number of completeness, then this seventh plague is the final complete expression of the wrath of God. We read chapter 16, verse 7, God says, it is done. God speaks. He says, what is done cannot be undone. The wrath to come. This is solemn stuff. None of us are up to speaking about it. None of us up to really hearing about it, are we? The wrath to come. So come with me to Revelation chapter 16. We're going to look together at verses 17 to 21. We're simply going to open up these verses and then we'll draw the lessons. So verse 17. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, it is done. So this seventh bowl is poured into the air. Why the air? We have our bowls of wrath poured out on the earth, the sea, the rivers, the sun. What's the significance of the air? Well, it's the most pervasive element of all. You can escape from the earth to the sea, you can escape from the sea to the earth, but where can you flee from the air? It's picture language, isn't it? What it's saying is, there is no escape. You cannot get away. So after six plagues, there is a sense in which God's anger remains. After six plagues, there is a fullness in his anger that we have yet to see. So after six incomplete expressions of the anger of God, we now come to this seventh plague, this cosmic, climactic, all-pervasive judgments from which there is no escape. The seventh plague which crowns his wrath. On the first 3 days of 1863, first few days of July, I should say, of 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg raged. And almost a third of the men who were engaged were lost. It was a great slaughter which determined the outcome of the American Civil War. And to describe the sheer scale of the engagement, someone spoke of the universe of battle. Nothing, it seems, was unaffected. The universe of battle. Well, here as we come to the seventh plague, we have the universe of God's wrath. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne. God now speaks, saying, "It is done." He's saying there's no way back. We remember the flood in Noah's day, don't we? How many perished in that judgment? But God's anger passed, the world continued. Today we experience floods, earthquakes, accidents, disease, wars. They are the judgments of God, but they're temporary judgments. They're partial judgments. They're always mixed with mercy. And we're shocked as we look at these six plagues. The sheer scale of them, the terror of them. And yet they all fall short of that expression of God's anger. But now, God says it's done. We've passed the point of no return. We can never go back. What's been done can never be undone. You can't get away from this one. There is no hiding place. There is no escape. Verse 18, and there were noises and thunderings and lightnings. It's a reminder, isn't it, of Sinai. You'll find the Revelation just simply sucks in the other 65 books of the Bible and just portrays them all the way through. It's a reminder of Sinai. What happened to Sinai? God himself touched the earth. And when the Holy One touches a world under the curse, then fire and wrath are inevitable. But that was then. And then, although God touched the earth and there was fire, the world was not consumed. But this is now. This is the end. God's great long suffering has come to an end. And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings. And there was a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as has not occurred since men were on the earth. A great earthquake, the mother of all tsunamis. It's a great shaking. It's been trailed in the Bible that a day is coming when everything will be shaken. And God says, now this is the final shaking. This is it. The writer of the Hebrews says, see that you do not refuse him who speaks. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth. But now he has promised, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth, but also heaven. The great shaking. Now this yet once more indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken, as of things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. The universe is shaking. This is the final convulsions of our universe. It's the end of everything. The end of all that I see, all that I touch. The final shaking. The destruction is universal. So all that people have ever lived for, fought over, cherished, desired, loved, bought, sold, created, designed, every triumph, every ambition, every hope, everything is shaken and destroyed. So what remains? Only that which cannot be shaken. And what's that? That's the kingdom of God, the kingdom which will outlast all other kingdoms. The new heavens and the new earth in which dwells righteousness, the world to come. God will shake this universe. So that all that remains is the world that is to come. Such a mighty and great earthquake as has not occurred since men were on the earth. Now, the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So all the cities of all the nations are going to be swept away in his anger. London, New York, Tokyo, Beijing, and one city in particular. It's called the Great City. And Great Babylon was remembered before God. Now remember, this is apocalyptic language. The language is symbolic. The book of Revelation tells us that really in this world there are only two cities. You're either a citizen of one or you're a citizen of the other. So what are the two cities? Well, there's Jerusalem, not the earthly Jerusalem, not that one, but the real Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, the city of God, the church. And then there's Babylon, the successor to Babel. Babylon, it's shorthand for all man's hopes and dreams for a world without God. And if they're two cities, they're also portrayed in Revelation as two women. So the New Jerusalem, she's a virgin bride, she's the bride of Christ. She's keeping herself pure for Christ, she's the church of God. And then there's Babylon. She's a prostitute. She's alluring, seductive, glamorous. You get it in chapter 17, verse 1, it says, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, the great prostitute, who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." Everyone sleeps with Babylon. Everyone goes to bed with her. What we won't do for a chance of pleasure, power, possessions, popularity, the things I can see and touch, what I won't do to possess them. And once you fall into her arms, you become so intoxicated with her that you can't break free and you become as filthy as she is. Well, God won't forget those who sleep with Babylon. Those who cut Christ out of their lives for what they think they can gain. And Great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. It's a very vivid picture. God will take Babylon, this prostitute, he'll take her by the hair. He'll force back her head. And he'll pour down her throat the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And Babylon, all man's pretensions of a world without God, so proud, so exalted, so self-important, raising ourselves up against God and against Christ. I don't need you. I don't want you. This is all that I want. The triumph, the ascent of man. Well, Babylon will stagger and vomit and fall and be shamed. Intoxicated with the wrath of God. So the end has come. Babylon falls. The nations fall. All that we see, all that we touch, all that feels so solid, so real, so permanent, the ground you walk on, the air that you breathe, the home you live in, the car that you drive, everything, 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 it will be shaken and removed. But you will live beyond it. Even the things we believed immovable will be moved. Verse 20, and every island, every continent fled away, and the mountains were not found. And if this is the seventh climactic plague, we now come to the climax. Verse 21. And great hail from heaven fell upon men. Each hailstone weighed about... So each hailstone about the weight of a talent. That's about 50 kilos. About 100 weight. Great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since the plague was exceedingly great. Again, it's picture language, but if the picture terrifies, how much more the reality? Do you see God's anger? God's anger has been held back through the long ages of man's hostility and rebellion. God has held his anger back, he's gathered it in, and it's been pent up in the long suffering of God. Well, now that anger explodes in this cosmic, climactic, cataclysmic seventh plague. And humankind is buried beneath an avalanche of God's wrath. The whole universe falls apart before the onslaught of his wrath, and rebellious humanity is buried under his judgment. This is it. There is no escape. There's no turning back. This is it. It's the end. There's no escape. But did you notice? Verse 21. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since the plague was exceedingly great. Men and women are destroyed, but they don't cease to exist. The creature, stripped of all the image of God, the creature endures, unrepentant, gnashing their teeth, cursing, blaspheming God. It's not life, but it is existence. A creature stripped of all humanity, raging impotently against all that is good and lovely and holy and pure, against God. But now raging against this wrath, wrath to the uttermost. An eternity of despair. No hope, no end. And all they can do is blaspheme God. The dying whispers as they go down through the ages, but never coming to an end. As Moses said, who knows the power of your anger? Who stops to think about God's wrath? Do you? Well, let's close with some lessons. Lesson number one. Christian friends, we've been thinking about hell, haven't we? The wrath to come. How many of my family and friends and neighbours, colleagues, are still living in the city of destruction? Still living as though this is the only world that counts? If I don't warn them, who will? Who's going to speak to them if it's not me? I might be the only Christian they know. So what is it that stops you from speaking to them about heaven and hell and sin and salvation and Jesus Christ? Maybe you know, I'm sure you have heard of Amy Carmichael's dream. She dreamed a dream. There was a cliff. Walking towards the edge, oblivious to the danger, were thousands of people. They didn't know the danger they were in because they were blind. And of course, each in their turn tumbled over the edge to their destruction. Now, here and there were people who could see. And seeing the danger, they were trying desperately to stop the people from walking over the edge of the cliff. But there were so many of them and so few of those who were trying to stop them that they managed to save only a handful. A little distance away, sitting on the grass, was a group of Christians. They could see, their eyes had been opened. But they just sat there. Every now and again, some of them would look up because they thought they heard a scream. Some even went to take a look. But in the end, they did nothing. Why? Well, because the Christians were busy. Doing what? Making daisy chains. Christian friends, how many around us are making their way with steady tread towards the edge of that cliff and hell? And are we, am I, busy making daisy chains? What is stopping me from speaking to others about Jesus? There's another lesson here. We've spoken about the wrath to come, and maybe some time ago in this sermon you switched off because you thought, well, here we go again, Christians talking about the wrath of God. Well, it's time to switch on. Whose anger do you fear? The person who flies off the handle, or the person who is never angry? The person who's always kind, patient, gentle, loving, and you've never seen them like this. Well, I know whose anger I fear. So if the wise, kind, patient, gentle, loving God, if he is angry, how wicked we must be to provoke him. You see, when God describes himself, he repeatedly says, he includes it in his name, he says he is slow to anger. God just doesn't get angry. You can provoke him and provoke him, but he just doesn't get angry. And if he does, it is only with incredible provocation over a long period of time. He's slow to anger. And again, when God describes himself, he repeatedly says he's abundant in love. He says, I can't exist without loving. He's slow to anger and he's abounding in love. So if that's the God that I've provoked, how rebellious and wicked I must be. Do you get it? It's not that God is easy to rile. It's almost impossible to get God angry. So if he is angry, and he's angry on this scale, how great must be my sin? We're not being harsh in saying these things. You know, there's a kind of wickedness. I can be so wicked that I actually live in denial. I don't think I am wicked. I get to a point where I cross a threshold and I look at myself and think, I'm fine. And it's not because I am. It's that it's a kind of wickedness that thinks that. Augustine, he tried to analyze his sin. He talked about a pear tree. He said, when he was a teenager, he and a gang of his friends, late one night, they went to this pear tree and they stole a huge load of pears. Why did they steal them? Because they were hungry? No, they just took the pears and they threw them at the pigs. Did they steal the pears because they were sweet and juicy? No, says Augustine, I had plenty of better tasting pears of my own. So why did he steal them? That's what he says. For the pleasure of doing something that was forbidden. My feasting was on the wickedness which I took pleasure in enjoying. If any of those pears entered my mouth, My criminality gave them their piquant sauce. It gave them their flavor. He said, I had no motive for my wickedness, but wickedness itself. He says, I was foul and I loved it. I loved my self-destruction. I loved my fall. Do you see, why do we defy God? Is it because there's a problem with God? No, we defy God because we're so sinful, we just love defying him. When God says, don't do something, that's my cue to go and do it. When God says, do something, that's my cue to refuse to do it. We love wickedness for its own sake. We enjoy it for what it is. I enjoy sin precisely because it is forbidden. I enjoy my fall. And you see, God is provoked as we take his love, his mercy, his kindness. Everything I have comes from him except my sin. God's provoked as we take those things for granted. He's provoked as we trash and trample upon any relationship which we might have with him. And he's provoked by the injustice of my lies and my adultery and my self-absorption and my hatred. And he's slow to anger, but he's provoked and provoked. I'm provoked, a lifetime of sinning, nations sinning, the human race sinning, until God says enough. One day he'll say to a whole world of iniquity and rebellion and injustice, enough. A loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, it's done, enough, I've finished it. But even as we speak about God's anger, do you know, there's a door opening, a door of mercy opening. See, if God is angry, why would he be angry? Or maybe part of the reason is he cares about his relationship with you. Maybe one of the reasons he's angry is because you've just trashed that relationship and say, it's rubbish, I don't want it, push off, go away. And God has been provoked because he cares about that. He cares about you. He cares about a relationship with you. A relationship which you insist on trashing. So maybe if he cares enough to be angry about it, he cares enough to provide a way back. And of course he does. And that way back is Jesus Christ. And he hangs upon a cross. And he suffers under the curse. And he's awash with blood under the scorching sun. As you look at that cross, you see the plagues. You see the seven plagues. And there's not even a drop of water to cool his burning tongue. I thirst. And he's utterly alone in the darkness. And in the end, his body and soul is crushed under an avalanche of God's wrath. We speak of those seven plagues. You go to Calvary, you will see them. The density, the weight compressed into those hours upon the cross. Oh, God cares about a relationship. Cares enough to be angry, but he cares enough to make a way back to him. And it's Christ, his own son, who suffers hell to the uttermost to save us from hell. Oh, that awful criminality, that fall, that forbidden things which I just like as they're forbidden. All my sins, all my filth are placed upon Jesus. And in those hours, the infinite Son endures the infinite wrath. So that all who call upon him can enjoy that relationship with God. Pure, lovely, holy, wonderful. They can enjoy the calm of sins forgiven. A new life, a new beginning, life everlasting. My friend, it's the cross. So if God is angry enough because of what you've trashed, well, he's made a way back. In wrath, he remembers mercy. He can't stop loving, you see. And says, come back. Don't keep on running. Come back. Come to Jesus Christ. Stand where my anger has fallen, and you'll be saved from the anger to come. But don't leave it. I can't promise you every day. I can promise you now. I can promise you today. And even as we've been sitting here tonight, we've all taken another step, haven't we, towards that edge called eternity. Who's not to say that with your next step, you might awake in hell? He only guarantees you one day, and that's today. So today, if you hear his voice, if you hear his pleading, don't harden your heart. Lord, you die to save condemned sinners. Well, that's me. I'm condemned. I'm a sinner. So, Lord, save me. Will you come? There's a final lesson. It's the final plague. God will have the glory. Mankind rebels. God spoke. They wouldn't listen. God sent his son. They put him to death. God raised his son from the dead, but they refused to believe. God exalted his son to his right hand, but they denied him worship. God spoke. God pleaded. God gave his son. But every voice they silenced, every goodness of God they abused, every gift he gave, they just took it and despised the giver. And they took God's patience, God's long-suffering, for weakness. So God said, temporary judgments to wake them up, but still they wouldn't change. God barred the way to hell with his commands. He says he commands everyone, everywhere, to repent. But still they wouldn't listen. And God held back his anger, held it in, not willing that any should perish. And still they rebelled. And they got worse and worse until the tares came to harvest. Until there was a ripeness of evil upon the earth. Until they started slaughtering the people of God wherever they found them. And still God held back. Until now. And if they refuse to glorify him, says God, I will yet have the glory. And if they refuse his salvation, says God, I will glorify my name in their destruction, so that at last people see the power of my anger. Is God too severe? Just look at their response. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. What can you do with such rebellion? All that remains is for God to glorify himself in their destruction.